Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net. If you want to do some call-ins, I would ask you to wait till the end of the hour, maybe the last 10 minutes. And you can join us every day at freeenergynews.com. We have as our guest today Lou Brown, who is CEO of Eneco, where they turn heat into electricity in a solid-state fashion. Lou, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Sterling. I'm glad to be here.
I should mention, for those who didn't have a chance to read our little write-up, I actually was able to come in and visit your facility last Wednesday. I got to see your little chip in action and verify that it does do what you say it's doing on your website. And I was very impressed with a lot of information you were able to give us that you're not able to give publicly. I was able to squeeze a little bit of that into my coverage. Did you get a chance to read my little preview article?
Yes, I did, Sterling. Thank you. I would say that's substantially correct. We technical types always want to nitpick a little bit here and there, and I have some of those, but I would say that certainly most of the information there is absolutely correct.
Good. Well, for those who are just joining us, haven't read the preview, and those who are listening to the archives later, give us a little quick rundown on what it is you have. What is this technology?
Yes, ours is a technology that is classified as energy conversion. That is to say, the technology is one that takes one form of energy, in our case it's heat, and converts it to another. In our case, that's electricity. Other examples that you're more familiar with perhaps would be a common automobile engine, which converts heat to shaft horsepower. Our output, without any moving parts, in our case, is electricity. This is a semiconductor device, and I would underscore the word device because we have to be deliberate in what we do, and we make a device in the same way that other people make other semiconductor devices, say like microprocessors or amplifiers or memory or whatever. So ours is a chip that's made for a special purpose. In our case, the design is deliberately one that converts heat that is applied to one side of the chip into electricity as that heat transits physically from one side of the chip to the other.
And how big is this chip?
Yeah, we are typical of semiconductor chip sizes in that we talk about millimeters. To visualize that for folks who aren't familiar with metric measurements, that's about the size of a peppercorn. We begin actually with a larger piece, just as you do when you make a silicon device. You may have seen pictures of a semiconductor operation where they have this large sausage-looking piece of very shiny material. It's called a boule, B-O-U-L-E, boule. That boule, in our case, is not made of silicon, but rather it is made of lead-tin telluride. And from that boule, we slice across the axis to make disks, which we call wafers. And those wafers, in our case, are about a millimeter thick, can be more, they can be less, and the specifics depend upon the application for which they're intended. But ultimately, from that disk of material, from that wafer, the individual chip that is cut out, which is also called a die, that chip is approximately 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter square. That's the footprint of it.
So I noticed you're being quite specific with your terminology of each step along the way. Is this industrially, like in a microchip world, this is typically what they're called, boule, wafer, chip, and die?
Exactly. Yes, it's one of the advantages we have with this technology that the manufacturing technology is already there and standing. We don't have to invent things. We simply have to lift from what is already in use within the industry. We use not all of the same tools, not all of the same processes, just as in any chip. We use those that are specific and that are specifically needed for making our particular device. But the reason I'm using this terminology is because that's what we use here as well. And it's probably familiar to people who are familiar with the silicon business, and so they can relate, I think, to what we are doing.
Right. it makes sense to use a similar terminology. Now, the dive that I saw was like 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter by 0.5 millimeter. Is that right?
That's about right, yes. And we do have variation in the thickness. That's not to be, it's nothing to be concerned about. It does not really affect the efficiency, which is the thing that we most focus on. It's done for other practical reasons. It depends upon the material. I should say, too, that although we have a commercial target of lead tin telluride, it's not the only material that we work with or have worked with in the past. And I would also point out that it's not the material that we're using for cooling applications.
Oh, really?
Something that we that you have included actually in the write-up, and I would underscore, is that this conversion technology, as for others as well, can be reversed. That is to say that if you add energy rather than extracting energy, you can make other things happen. Just as in the case of a thermoelectric, the so-called Peltier effect, when you add power to that thermoelectric element, it will move heat from one side to the other. That's called Peltier effect. We can do the same. And again, the differentiation in our case is that our chip has been specifically designed for the kind of functionality we have. And part of that specific design is to ensure that we have significantly higher efficiencies than other products that are already in the marketplace. And this naturally is done for business purposes. There's not much point in being a me too. We want to be something that's significantly better than what is offered out there for competitive reasons.
Right. So it would be better both for extracting heat, turning waste heat into energy, or even solar or geothermal low heat into electricity, as well as using electricity to use a refrigeration effect, for example, for a laptop or a motherboard in a computer.
Yes, that is correct. To make a slight correction to what you said, Sterling, the laptop application that we see is not so much for refrigeration, because that, as you could appreciate, would require more power. And with a laptop, power is at a premium because there's a very limited quantity in the battery. But instead, what manufacturers are interested in is to take the heat that is generated by the microprocessor within the laptop and generate additional electricity by harvesting that heat and turning it into electricity. And although the absolute amounts are rather small and don't sound as though they are appealing, in the case of a laptop, every little bit helps. And in this case, the amount of heat that you can convert to electricity and the resulting number of watts that you can produce from the microprocessor just happen to match rather well with the requirements for the cooling fans. So that would be the scheme. Harvest heat from the microprocessor, convert some of it to electricity, and then drive the cooling fans. So you offload the rest of the electrical system, thereby extending the battery life.
One of the things we've not addressed yet that I think is important to kind of get people oriented to this technology is the temperature range where you see this being feasible commercially. And if I understand right, that's between 200 and 600 degrees Celsius. Is that right?
Yeah, the area of commercial interest, which I would distinguish from what is technically feasible, the area of commercial interest extends from about 600 degrees Celsius down to about 200 degrees. We can operate at other temperatures, but on the low end, as you might appreciate, since our efficiency is a function of the difference in temperature, the high temperature and the low temperature against which we work, the efficiency changes. And at some point, the question is a commercial one of whether it is important enough to generate electricity with those low temperatures that you're willing to pay the higher price for it. At the high end, it is not that we can't work beyond 600 degrees. It's that at about 600 degrees, and this is not a hard and fast rule, it's not a cliff or the edge of the world, but at about 600 degrees and above, materials problems begin to creep in all around. And it's not just ourselves, it's other people around us, or other materials, I should say, that would be in a system around us. So the commercially interesting area for us is from about 200 degrees to about 600 degrees.
From what I understand, the size of the chip is exponentially proportional to the power volts and many amps output. So you want to stay small because you get too many amps going in your modules, and then you join these together. I guess a module is the right word for many in a system. About how big would be too big, where you start getting too much amperage?
Let me just slightly correct your language, Sterling. It's not exponential, but rather it's according to the area. When we characterize our chips, one of the characteristics we measure always is the current density, which is the number of amps per square centimeter. We normalize to centimeters in this case. And typically, an operating chip will generate a few hundred amps per square centimeter. Well, in normal applications, a few hundred amps is much, much larger than what you would like to manage and what is required for that particular application. If you think about your house, for example, your fuse box typically has fuses or breakers for things like 15, 20, maybe 30 amps. To compare that denomination with a size, in our case, gives us then this millimeter by millimeter type of geometry. From one square millimeter, we can easily generate 10 or 15 amps. And so that is what regulates the size that we work with. If we were to go to anything that has a larger area, say two times or three times larger, of course we would generate two times or three times more of that current. And pretty soon it becomes hard to manage, or harder to manage. So our preference, since the structure into which we fit these chips, as you mentioned, is called a module, our preference is for the chips within a module to be producing current in the range of, say, 10 to 20 amps, but certainly not in the 100 amp range, which then means that we're working with millimeter size chips.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of size, one skeptic has said that it's very difficult to secure such small things in an industrial type of setting where you have shake, rattle, roll types of situations. And you don't seem to be deterred by that at all.
Oh, not at all, because I don't believe the statement. As something just to ponder in support of my statement, think of the electronics in your automobile. All of the solid state, all the electronics in your car are made with these same processes, generally speaking, chips that are on the same size. If you look at what's inside your microprocessor, except for the processor itself, the individual chips will also be about the same size. And we have microprocessors all over cars, don't we? Likewise, if you look at what gets launched into space, survives the harshness of the environment there, plus the launch and so on. These are all solid-state devices, and they operate for years and years and years. It's not a problem. The source chip, so to speak, is small, but that doesn't equate to this being a problem.
You actually turned it around and said that the small size is an advantage because the force equals mass times acceleration, and
mm-hmm.
where you have the jostling around, the smaller mass actually equates to smaller force because you're reducing the mass, and therefore it's actually less stress on the components rather than more.
Yes, that's precisely right, and I think the listeners can easily imagine this let's say, think about a BB that you rattle in a box, and you can hear it striking the walls of that box. And if you replace the BB with a corresponding amount of styrofoam, which has significantly less mass, and you try to rattle that in the box, you hear nothing. And the reason is, just as you said, that the force is proportional to the acceleration. And so for a small mass, there's a lot less force with the same acceleration. So that the forces that would stress this chip and cause possible problems are significantly less because of the masses being significantly less than other components around them.
One thing we've not talked about that I would like to bring up early to just kind of get people excited and turned on to why this is significant.
Mm-hmm.
In my write-up, I make the assertion that if you were to replace the photovoltaic component of a concentrated solar system with one of these Eneco chips, that you would cut your price in half and double the energy output. Is that a pretty close approximation?
Yeah, that is. The typical, and you referenced the Stirling engine version of these. Stirling engines have been around for a long, long while. So it's proven technology, and therefore in concentrated solar, it's one of the places people reach for the technology to convert the heat that they obtain to some sort of mechanical motion in that case, which then drives the alternator to produce electricity. Now, in our case, we are able to work at exactly the same location as the Stirling engine in a concentrated solar application, and we do not represent the same large mass. We're really rather small, as we've just discussed. We're very tiny by comparison with most mechanical means for conversion. So that's one thing. The actual converter itself from one form to another is small. The next is that in a single step rather than two steps, we make electricity. We don't have to have an additional alternator, which by itself, as we can all experience in our automobile, if you've ever lifted the automobile's alternator, it's really very, very heavy. So we eliminate two components, replace them by one system, which is our own. We are not a mechanical metal heavy system in that same location, so we save a lot of weight. We save a lot of space as well. So it is certainly a desirable area for us to be, and looks as though it has advantages all around. There's zero maintenance for something that has no moving parts. We do have other components that would require some maintenance, so it's not totally maintenance-free. For example, just as in the Stirling case, we need to remove heat from our cold side, so there's a radiator system that's already there in these solar concentrators. We would use that as well, but predominantly what you should see is that we eliminate a very large piece of structure, a large amount of mass that has moving parts, requires maintenance, and we replace it with something that is very compact, very high energy density from this, has only a single unit, so to speak, not a separate mechanical to electrical converter and heat to mechanical converter. And so overall, you can see that the problem becomes far more tractable.
Maybe a better comparison then, rather than a Stirling engine, would be a photovoltaic cell. How would that compare?
Yeah, and in the photovoltaic cell case, we both have the advantage of no moving parts. We both have the advantage of being small. The difference there that we see is one of plain business. That is to say that for that same functionality, we cost quite a lot less. We also have an advantage, we believe, although this needs to be proven, in terms of longevity. We hear from the triple junction photovoltaic manufacturers themselves that there are, in fact, problems of fatiguing and so on. Although they're able to get pretty decent conversion efficiencies, this comes at a price in terms of lifetime for the photovoltaic itself. Now, in our case, the expected lifetimes that we see are very, very long. So in that same application, what we would expect would be that from a financial point of view, we would be significantly more effective. First, because the capital cost for initial installation would be significantly less due to our low manufacturing cost. And second, because of the lifetime that we would expect from our devices, we would then amortize that same cost, that low cost, over a longer period of time. So in a basic cost-benefit type of analysis, we believe that we are winners.
So the materials that you're anticipating using have been proven in the field to hold up under the UV, the harsh sun types of conditions that usually destroys or denigrates a lot of different materials.
Yeah. In our case, we depend just upon heat, and we don't care what the source of the heat is. It can be generated from solar, it can be generated from combustion or whatever. But that's one point, is that the source doesn't matter to us. It doesn't provide any particular problem to us that the heat is generated by one means or another. Heat is heat. It's all part of the electromagnetic spectrum, if you want to get very fundamental about it. The other is the question of, I believe what you might be referring to is the survivability in some harsh environments. And I think the acid test there, the real litmus test for survivability, is what has happened in NASA's space program, where for those interplanetary explorer satellites and those that have done solar system exploration, there has to be a source of power, and it's not photovoltaic because there's not enough solar flux when you get into the regions of the outer planets, as an example. And so those spacecraft carried with them what is called a radioisotope thermal generator. This is using old technology, but very reliable. It's thermoelectric technology, and it just happens that we are using the same materials, which is one of the reasons why we are so confident about our own longevity. Those spacecraft, the Explorer series, used, among other things, lead tin telluride, the same family of materials that we are commercializing. And they lasted until they were thrown out of the solar system, tens of years. So we expect that we should see the same performance. This, by the way, is accessible to the public, is well documented by NASA. They did a very nice study in terms of longevity, actually the performance over time of these power sources. And although I don't have a specific web reference for you, you could look this up and satisfy yourself about that aspect. It's also very satisfying to us, of course, because we don't have to necessarily do as much work in order to determine what our own longevity is.
One thing that I meant to include in my write-up that you reminded me just now of is, I believe you made the comment in our visit last Wednesday that thermoelectric technology actually predated the combustion engine. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't believe I said exactly that, but I do agree with you. Yeah, because with the possible exception of steam engines, because steam power has been around for a long, long while. But in terms of what we think of, well, you said internal combustion, steam engine is an external combustion. Yeah, the gasoline, diesel, and so on that we see every day on the highway now is only 100 plus a little bit years old, whereas the thermoelectric technology has been around for about 150 years. You're absolutely right. Now, the form of it in the beginning is something that, again, is still familiar, I think, to many people, and we actually use it ourselves here in the laboratory for determining temperatures. It's something called a thermocouple. It is the thermoelectric effect. So it's still commonly in use, but the current form of it for making power or for providing cooling is quite different. It's no longer wires, but rather it's solid-state devices, just as we use. And we, in fact, have developed our own technology in part based upon a desire to have some of the positive features of thermoelectric converters. Some of those include their ability to work at these lower temperatures that we discussed earlier, as opposed to needing to go to extremely high temperatures where you encounter many difficulties. And the fact that they are solid-state devices as well. They don't use exactly the same solid-state technology we do, but they are solid-state in the sense that they have no vacuum components, which leads to the other technology from which our own has sprung, and that is what is called vacuum thermionic.
Now, talking about all this other work, you know, this technology has been around for 150 years. There's obviously a lot of man-hours, a lot of IP tied up, and a lot of prior art. I'm curious, how many patents have you secured, and how much of a niche do you have carved out in terms of your exclusive IP?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, our technology, as I began to discuss, is partly based on two previous technologies. One is the thermionic, vacuum thermionic devices, and the other is the thermoelectric. When we began developing this technology, found that we were unique. There was no work done that was exactly this idea. There had been some earlier suggestions in the literature, but it was what we would call like a Duncan experiment. You know, wouldn't it be nice if, or I wonder if it's possible if, or perhaps someone should try this. But it had never been done until we did it. So that put us then in the position of being there first, but it also is kind of a lonely place to be, because instead of being able to springboard off lots of other work done by colleagues, co-workers, say in the same university or the same industrial lab, we've had to do the full heavy lifting, the heavy deep R&D work ourselves, and had to also fund that ourselves. Well, that's a two-edged sword. It means, first of all, that we are the owners of what there is because we've developed it and we've patented it. But it also means that we've had to bear the brunt of financing all of that. So it's a two-way street. But we find ourselves now in the position that we have current count as of today about 48 patents that are issued or applied. Of those, 10 are U.S. patents that are issued. We have another 7, 8, 9, I believe, at this point in time that are issued in other jurisdictions, and the balance then pending in various states. So we've developed quite a lot, quite a body of IP, and we do intend to continue in that mode. And having done that, I would say that I would point out that from the commercial aspect, we are certainly willing to license our IP as well, because this is something that we would not like to hide under a bushel, but rather we would like to have spread as something that is great for humanity and looks very much to us as though it's a job that can't be done by a single company. We need to have a lot of partners, a lot of joint venturers, and so on, in order to make this available to the general public, and on the selfish side, for us to be a commercial success.
Right. Now, what kind of door knocking have you had along those lines?
Well, we have, I'd say, two types, and I'm not complaining about either. One is that we do have quite a number of inquiries on a daily basis from individuals, people who have heard about us in one way or another and have an idea. And we certainly like to encourage these people, and we appreciate that they've taken the time to contact us. But by and large, we're not prepared to deal with a large number of customers. We are prepared to deal with a small number of large customers. So the other kind of inquiry we get, and the other kind of business that we have ourselves initiated, is with people that we see have already a stake in an area. They have a market, they have sales, manufacturing, service, etc., distribution, and have a product in a specific market where we believe that we can provide a replacement that gives them an advantage. And to describe some of that and the direction we are headed, we have examined very carefully the power generating realm from about 10 kilowatts down to a few watts. And if you look in that market realm, what you find is that the sources of power there are very premium priced. For instance, if you look at a laptop battery, the price you pay for that battery plus the recharge of it, which is almost insignificant, but the price you pay for the service it gives you compared with buying that same electricity from the mains is about 150 to 170 times what that electricity would have cost if you had simply plugged it into the wall. Well, I'm not throwing stones at people who make batteries. I'm saying that that represents a real market opportunity because here is real premium pricing for that particular function. And we see this all along the way. And as I pointed out, the other end of the spectrum is this about 10 kilowatt cutoff. It's not really a cutoff, but it's a point where applications begin to change from those that are, say, emergency power, backup power, ATM power, and auxiliary power units and things of this sort to being much larger installations. So why can we operate in that region? Why do we find an advantage there? Well, it's because, number one, we see that the products in that area are premium priced, so there's commercial opportunity. If you can come in below the current cost structure and take advantage of that premium pricing, the market gives you wider margins, in other words. And the other reason is, why would you be able to compete? And that has to be done on a benefit basis, a technical competition basis. And what we find by, again, looking at the current entries into that particular region is that predominantly the mechanical conversion technology that you find at the 10 kilowatt level and moving on down is falling off very rapidly in efficiency. And this equates then to a high cost, high capital cost for the initial installation for, on a per watt basis, as well as high operating costs. So all of this put together says that there's a significant opportunity here, and we are actively pursuing companies who participate in some way in that particular portion of the market. So that's one that we see, and one kind of customer or partner we're pursuing. The other is for waste heat from industrial process. And again, an inquiry would not probably come from an individual in this case, but rather from a company, typically the plant people or the general management and so on. And we are, at the present time, working with a number of people who have the type of problem that goes something like this. Their process, no matter what it is, either consumes a lot of electricity, or maybe their end product is electricity, but a significant amount of their product cost is electrical generation. They have heat that they generate in making their product, which is not useful any longer. And some examples, geothermal power plants fall into this category. They have, if they use the extraction injection well technique, for example, the Puna power plant on the Big Island of Hawaii, what they have is a large amount of heat that has to be reinjected back into the earth. And the reason they do that is that they don't have a way of converting that heat to electricity because of its low temperatures, no longer useful for driving conventional turbine technology. Okay, so that's one of these cases. Another is arc furnaces in steel mills. We're dealing with an installation in the Midwest that uses a 50 megawatt arc furnace. What comes into that plant is automobile bodies and so on, and they dump these things together into a very large arc furnace, and from that arc furnace we get a huge amount of effluent that is very hot gas, metal bits, and all of this that you could imagine comes along with the scrap metal. That, for environmental reasons and others, is taken off by a large ductwork. The first thing they need to do is to cool all of that hot gas and those particles, and so they have 200 feet of water jacket whose function is to cool that effluent stream. Well, what a waste that is. What these people really need is more electricity. What they don't need is that heat. And so, again, it provides an opportunity for us. Similar situation with electrolytic smelters. These are people who make magnesium, make aluminum, and products in that category, where electricity is the means for making that ore, the raw product, the raw material, into the primary metal. And again, they need electricity in order to make their product, but in the process of making their product, that electricity also generates an enormous amount of heat, but the heat is not useful to them. Benefit to them is to be able to take that heat, convert it to additional electricity, thereby reducing their consumption or reducing their operating costs or their product costs. So that area, that whole that area that is characterized by having waste heat, no conversion technology, a desire for electricity, is one that we're looking at as well, and we're actively pursuing companies who have problems that fall into that category. One that we might not ordinarily think of, since I've mentioned industrial processes, that does fall in the same category, however, is that of automobiles, where, again, the need is for additional electricity. Automobiles consume on the average, I believe that the long-term average right now is 10% more electricity per year. And alternator technology has come to the point where it's very awkward to try to milk additional electricity off a smaller and smaller engine and still have this thing run quietly and so on. So automobile manufacturers are highly desirous of finding alternate methods of generating electricity. And one of those that we're working with automobile companies to do is to take the waste heat that's represented by the exhaust gas and produce electricity from it. And the opportunity is huge. If you think about the efficiency of internal combustion vehicles, DOE numbers are about 13%, 14%, 15% efficiency is represented by the automobile's conversion of fuel to power at the wheels. Before you get to the wheels, however, and you're looking at the engine, the other side of the transmission, so to speak, it's commonly stated that you can divide that gallon of fuel into about thirds. One third of it ultimately results in something that the engine is doing. One third of it is waste heat that is exhausted through the coolant system, and the other third is sent out through the exhaust system. These are not completely exact numbers, but it's approximately right. So the point to be made is that of that gallon of fuel, you throw away a great deal of it. And if you could take that and make it useful, you've done something very beneficial. And that's exactly the direction we're headed, and that's the kind of customer we're looking for.
Now let's take some of these examples. I'm thinking of some questions as we go. On the laptop, for example,
yes,
you're harvesting the heat that's coming from the processor. Where are you getting your delta T? You need to have a heat differential for this to be efficient.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Sterling. It's sometimes people will come to us and say, I have, could you put this inside your body, for example, and make electricity? And the answer is no. If you surround this with all the same temperature, you don't get any electricity from it. You do have to have what we call a delta T, that is a gradient physically across the chip, so that one side is physically hotter than the other side. Excuse me, is that something I should pay attention to?
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, we're a little past the bottom of the hour. On a monthly basis, we're having a four-minute segment from Zenya where she talks about how we can reduce our energy footprint. So if we could turn the time over to her for maybe 2 to 4 minutes, and then we'll resume with the program. Just go ahead and hang on the line there, and when she's done, we'll plug back in.
Sure.
Okay, greetings and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Global warming is now a topic that everyone is aware of, and the latest news is a giant ice shelf that snapped near the North Pole. It's the Isles Ice Shelf. The size is 41 square miles. Scientists citing climate changes as a major reason for this breaking. In a new scientific study predicted a much more rapid oscillation of the melting Arctic ice than previously anticipated. Polar bears and all Arctic animals are in peril. The ice sea is already melting, and polar bears are drowning in record numbers off Alaska's coast. This year, 2007, could be the hottest year on record because of El Nino and climate changes. Already this year, there were temperatures in the 60s and 70s in Washington, D.C. Rose bushes are sprouting new growth, and flowers are popping up, cherry blossoms blooming. People in Minnesota are canceling ice fishing tournaments. The ski resorts were opened in October in the West, and the three major record-breaking blizzards in Colorado just happened, shut down everything, and their economy is really suffering. Cattle are starving in 3 to 6 foot drifts, which is all record-breaking. So climate change is not a debate anymore, and climate scientists concur that we must address climate changes now. They agree that accumulating carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping smokestack tailpipe gases probably pose a major environmental challenge. These emissions are causing the planet to warm up, and humans are responsible for this increase. These experts see a clear need for the public to engage now, but not to panic, but that the response would require far more than switching to fluorescent light bulbs and to hybrid cars. Society should be putting more money into alternative renewable energy and instituting controls or caps on carbon dioxide emissions and grow a new renewable energy industry that creates new jobs. And here are some tips as a reminder. Make a list for yourself on things that you should do in your daily activities to take action. A few of the things are like unplug electronics in your home when not in use, and use the energy-efficient light bulbs, recycle everything possible, reduce packaging material, choose a renewable energy vehicle to drive, plant trees, hang out clothes to dry, carpool, walk, use public transit, and even fly less. Invest in green buildings and so forth. Investigate using solar energy. Use Energy Star products. You can learn more on websites such as energystar.com for a list of products, climatecrisis.com, and climatechange.com. And, of course, the film An Inconvenient Truth is available on DVD now. So encourage your school and businesses to reduce emissions. You can download toolkits to give them. Walmart just announced that they are going green, so now you can buy energy-saving products there. So together, we all can make a difference. We just have to do it. Blessings.
Thank you, Zenya.
Okay,
Lou, back to you. We were talking about delta T and why you need to have a temperature differential and how you can establish something like that in, say, a laptop computer.
Sure. Yeah, first of all, let me just say that I couldn't hear Zenya completely, but what I did hear is really the case that we make often for why this kind of technology is important. As you look at energy consumption worldwide as related to global warming, the amount of fossil fuel that is consumed is, of course, the dominant source of energy. In the U.S., for example, a little over 40% of our energy is from petroleum. About 23% comes from natural gas, and about another 23% comes from coal. The renewable energy portion of our consumption is only about 6%, and the balance, the 8% more or less, is from nuclear. So you can see that a very small portion of what we consume, all of us, is from renewable sources. Now, we are not a renewable source as you might think of it in the sense that you grow us or whatever, but we expand on this theme by pointing to the value of conservation, and we look at ourselves in that light as being a conservation technique. That energy that's consumed worldwide in terms of the cost of it is also huge. Just the fossil fuels, those three that I've mentioned, the petroleum, natural gas, and coal, the latest reliable data is that that costs about $1.9 trillion. And DOE estimates that 30 to 70% is what is actually useful, and the balance is wasted. So let's say for rough numbers, 50% is wasted. It literally goes up in smoke. And the price tag, if you're just looking at the price of that, is roughly $1 trillion. A huge, huge opportunity here. If you only looked at this from a commercial point of view and you didn't even care about the environmental impact, there's already just a huge motivation for working in this area. And it's part of why we are here. We do have that kind of civic responsibility that we feel. Sometimes you might laugh at this and get a giggle, but we sometimes tell potential investors that this is an opportunity to do well by doing good. And it is the way that we view things. It is an opportunity that we feel we should pursue, not just as a commercial opportunity, but by way of being responsible citizens on the planet.
Returning to your question,
yeah, Sterling, about...
If I could carry on that note just a little bit, too. I refer, you know, your technology falls into my vernacular of free energy, because it is energy that goes to waste that is not being used, that is free for the taking. Why throw it away? Why not put it to use? And so, you know, you'll see that you're listed in our top 10 in our of the top 100 energy technology listing by the New Energy Congress at top100energy.com. I think you're at position 6 or something like that, or even higher.
Mm-hmm.
Because of a lot of reasons, of the efficiencies, of the price point. And I would consider it renewable in as much as we produce a lot of waste heat in our present society, and even when we go clean. Solar energy as a source of heat, geothermal as a source of heat, and even some of the waste heat that might come off of a turbine or a generator in a wind farm, you could harness perhaps some of that. And so there's a lot of renewable sources of waste, of quote waste heat, and
right.
I don't think it's going to be going away anytime soon.
Yep, and that's why when you asked about the kind of customers or partners we're looking for, I identified this industrial segment, because when we think about waste heat from burning of fossil fuels, that's normally what we think about, is some industrial process, but transportation is a very, very high contributor to that as well. So in that sense, that group of customers have a huge amount of importance to us, and we're very eager to work with them because we have this double motivation. One is it's a chance to be commercially successful, and the other is that it's an absolute necessity. One of our investors works for a consulting, is a consulting firm working for Wall Street. I can identify him because we do on our website. It's Charles Maxwell from Whedon & Co. Charles made a quote some time ago that we think is right on, and that is that the cheapest barrel of oil is the one that is not consumed, the one that you conserve, the one you avoid consuming. And so that's a lot of our motivation right there, because we see the opportunity to do well by doing good. Simple as that.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, back to the subject of Delta T and where you can find that in some of these sources, such as a laptop.
Yes, in the laptop, first of all, what is Delta T? Delta T simply means that you have two different temperatures, the difference between them we refer to as the delta T. Now, within a laptop or any other electronic device, everything is not all the same temperature. So if you look around in a computer, what you'll find is that the lion's share of the energy is consumed, and therefore sloughed off by those things associated with the microprocessor as the input-output, the arithmetic processing unit, all of that that goes into that one small area. Well, that is terrific for us, first of all, because you only have to deal with that area, not the entire board, as if, for instance. But it is hotter than everything else surrounding it, so it automatically comes with a delta T. So in one way of visualizing this, we would, in essence, tile the microprocessor package with our devices. And by being in intimate contact, we would have the hot side assured. The fact is, however, we have to have a cold side as well. Otherwise, we'll just go to the, we'll all be the same temperature and no electricity will be generated. So you must cause that to happen. And as you know, also, there is a heat sink that is on your microprocessor that is used for cooling it, dragging the heat out, dissipating it by blowing air over it, typically with a fan, or there are others as well, other ways of doing this. But typically what you see is a metal heat sink that has air flowed over it. And in the case of the laptop, what you need to do is interpose yourself between the actual processor package and the heatsink. So the heatsink provides you the cold side, the microprocessor is the hot side, and there you go. You have a difference in temperature, and that's what you have to have in order to be able to generate electricity with our technology.
What about the situation where you're harvesting, let's say, exhaust energy coming out of an engine?
Yeah, in that case, there are two ways. Let me talk about the hot side first and what's required. A simple view that we, I don't mean to demean someone who is writing to us by email, but people are thinking out there, and they see a hot exhaust pipe, and they say, couldn't I just put this on my exhaust pipe? Well, it's not quite that simple. To make something truly effective, you need to properly engineer it and design it. And so the usual embodiment is that a section of exhaust pipe, and preferably at the hottest possible location, is made to a special heat exchanging section, the idea being similar to what you have in your catalytic converter. That is to say, not all of the exhaust pipe is the same all the way from the engine to where you see it poking out the back of the car, but rather there's a muffler in there someplace, and there's this catalytic converter in there someplace, and hopefully in the future there will be a section that makes electricity. It has to be designed for that. So that's the first thing. And what that design does, that specific design does, is to allow the heat that is within the exhaust to be brought to the surface and be presented for conversion by our technology. So that's the first thing that needs to be done. That establishes the hot side. The cold side then, we will use a heat spreader, as we call it, which is cooled and establishes a delta T across the converter elements. The cooling can be provided in at least two ways. One way of doing this is to simply use the normal engine coolant. In degrees C, the coolant is about 100 degrees. The exhaust, as it's presented, the heat as it's presented to our converter elements, is on the order of 500 to 600 degrees C. And so there you are. You have a very nice delta T established, and the whole idea works. The other possible way of making a cool side is to just use ambient air. Use something, let's say, like a finned type of heat sink, common as we see them in, let's say, the microprocessor case, and blow air over that. Maybe a little more sophisticated than that, a ducted type of approach, perhaps, or something of this sort. But those are some of the nuts and bolts that go into this. The fact is that you do have to have a delta T, however, for this technology to work, and you can see how that is established in these cases.
We're almost out of time, and I would be remiss if we didn't talk about the history a little bit of where you got started. You actually got your start with cold fusion technology at the University of Utah 2 years after Martin and Fleischmann made their big announcement. Eneco was formed to, as if I understand right, for the purpose of how do we harness this low heat into a productive capacity? And so the ENICO was tasked with coming up with a way of extracting energy from low heat. Is that correct?
It's a little bit off the mark. The company as formed wanted to trade in the IP, that is, be the licensing agent and so on. And so they actually made a deal with the university that whatever IP came from the university, the company would be the licensing agent for that. And that was the business paradigm. But as you know, that turned out to be a very unworkable paradigm. There was not IP, was not enough IP or whatever. And so it was also realized at the same time that we had assembled a technical team in order to assess these situations that had capability for dealing with the rest of the problem, the rest of the problem being that if cold fusion produces heat, there has to be some other way of converting that heat to something that's more fungible, such as electricity. And a look around showed that there was no technology such as that which we have now developed, that is something that can work at these temperatures and has high efficiency. So that was the motivation for moving on to conversion technology. It was a business decision, since there was not a viable business being a licensing agent, but there was the possibility that there were other applications as well as for cold fusion in the conversion technology, we moved on. In point of fact, the company has no work in the cold fusion area, and it has not since about 1996-1997. We have converted completely over to looking at energy conversion devices, which does have viability as a business.
Mm-hmm. Two quick questions. We'll need to make them really quick. Your website, and number two, if people want to invest, where do they go?
Okay. Our website is simple. It's just www.enico, that's E-N-E-C-O, enico.com. There's lots of information there. I would invite people to peruse it, and if they have any questions about it, they can use the website to request additional information. There is an information request section there. With regard to investment, we are investor-funded. We are in what might be described as a quiet period right now because we're doing a funding raise, and we're doing that in the UK, as it happens. But if there are people who are interested in participating in that, I can put them in touch with the dealer broker investment house who are doing that work for us. There may not be opportunity for everyone because there are some restrictions on who can invest since this is a UK offering and not a US offering. But institutions in particular, I believe, have no problems. Individuals may. Just a little heads up on that. But if someone who is interested should contact us, and we'll make the appropriate arrangements.
Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a fascinating interview, and we wish you great success in what you're doing, Lou.
Well, thank you, Sterling. I appreciate the opportunity. I run a very open shop here and would invite people who have questions to please either contact me or go to the website and ask for information via the information request section. We're delighted to see the interest that people have in us, and we would be very happy to answer any questions that might arise as a result of this broadcast.
Thank you. This has been Sterling Allen with Free Energy Now. You can join us every day at freeenergynews.com.
This week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.